Broadcasting from deep within the second realm, you are listening to agoristradio.com.
Hello, this is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. Agoristradio.com is sponsored by MetroPie.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Cypherpunked. Today we have another very special guest, fellow traveler, who is the creator of the Open Transactions Digital Cash Market System. He's going to explain all the little facets of this system and how it comes together, how we can understand it, and some of the interesting things that can be done with it.
We'll be right back.
Harold, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming on the show. So there's all these projects that have been popping up lately. It seems like a lot of the ideas and dreams and discussions of a lot of the cypherpunks in the past just now are starting to come to fruition. And one of the systems that has popped up over this past year is your open transactions digital cash system. This is not one of the account-based systems. It actually works with tokens, and it's a little bit more interesting than just a basic token system with blinding and a purse. So why don't we start off with you giving us a general idea in a nutshell about open transactions, what it is, and we'll go into some more detail. And actually, before that, can you tell us why in the world did you decide to sit down and code this? What led up to this, and what are your ideas, and how do you feel about the development now that you are into it, and some of your ideas on where you see this going in terms of plans for implementation and people using this system?
I first got interested in digital cash years ago, when it was kind of a news item back in the 90s in the tech news. And I always had an interest in it. And at some point, what I wanted to do was write some kind of digital cash client, like a nice little wallet software that you could use on your computer.
Uh-huh.
And I was looking around for a digital cash library that I could, because I was a pretty skilled programmer. And I thought, well, I can make a nice client, like a Windows client or a Java client or something. And all I have to do is call into this digital cash library, and I can make it happen. And I started looking around. This was probably over 12 years ago now, 13 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I started looking around, and I couldn't find a digital cash library. And what I did find was Lucre by Ben Laurie, which is an excellent piece of work. And I downloaded it, and I thought, okay, I'm going to make a – I actually started making a little wallet screen. And then I started playing around with Lucre, and I realized, oh, man, all it really does is the mathematics. It does the blinding and unblinding.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I can take a key and I can blind it and unblind it, but it's not really a digital cash library. It's just a blinding library.
Mm-hmm.
And so I realized there was no digital cash library. And so I gave up on the project, and, my life and career took me out of programming and out of technology in general. And it was only a year ago, I was at a party I threw. And I was talking to this guy, Sammy, who was a hacker guy, kind of a well-known guy. He made the Ever Cookie. You ever heard of that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The Ever Cookie. And so this is the guy who, he was a teenager, and he shut down MySpace with a MySpace worm that made everyone say, Sammy is my hero on their MySpace blog or whatever. Anyway, he showed up at a party at my house, and he asked me if I had any knowledge about digital cash. And he said he had a friend that knew I had researched it before, had some interest in it earlier in my life. And that sparked me to go back and looking into programming and looking into what projects are out there today and, what's going on out there now and what's available. Yeah. It's kind of cool to not really look for a few years and then see all the new cool stuff that you missed. But
yeah.
In any case, what I discovered was that there was some cool stuff there, like TrueLedger, that was cool. Loom, that was really cool. There's some other stuff like that, PKTP, other systems. But I still didn't see a digital cash library where I could do financial cryptography, where I could write my own little app and have a library to make the calls to do it.
Uh-huh.
And so I started researching it more and more and deeper. I started looking into the designs behind all these different systems, and I feel like they all solve different problems. And I could see all the merits of all of these systems and the cool things that they did. Like, not many people realize, for example, what TrueLedger does so well is that TrueLedger makes it possible to destroy your account history. And with any system that uses accounts, It turns out if you try and code one with your computer, it turns out that you don't really have a choice. You're forced to store your entire account history forever. And unless you have
to do accounting, is that
like in order to cover your ass later, in order to prove that a check was cleared or not, or that a trade occurred or not, yeah. or that a withdrawal occurred or not, to be able to prove these things later and for your receipts to have any meaning, it turns out that normally both parties and all parties have to store all their receipts forever, and this is a growing database forever, and that's the default situation unless you make some special mechanism to get around it.
Yeah.
And that's what True Ledger does. True Ledger has a special mechanism that Bill St. Clair, he calls it destruction of account history.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is it's a special little mechanism that enables them to prove which transactions are open and which ones are closed and which ones have cleared and which ones haven't. And no one has to store their entire transaction history to do that. They just store the last receipt. And you can destroy everything. So it doesn't mean that you should destroy everything. I mean, you can keep your records, but it means that you're no longer forced to keep everything mm-hmm. for the system to work, just for the system to work.
Right.
You see what I mean? And so I think that's a cool idea. I thought True Ledger, you know, this destruction of account history, that's a cool idea. You know, Loom had a cool idea too with the giant digital space.
Mm-hmm.
But I still didn't see a transaction server that did untraceable cash, like the David Chaum untraceable cash. And I thought, motherfucker, I have not looked into this for like 12 or 13 years, and not a single person has still made available some little thing I can pop up play around with Chaumy and cash.
Uh-huh. Yeah, not much has been going on. I mean, you took off for a while, but there really hasn't been that much going on since you've been gone, just within the past 1 or 2 years. I mean, I know Loom has been around for a little bit. I'm not sure how long Bill's been working on his, but and the PTK stuff by, you know, the PT,
like Mike
PK, you know. Go ahead.
PKTP, Andrew McMichen, that guy. Australia, I think.
Yes, Andrew, uh-huh.
Yeah. But, I mean, I would honestly, you asked me, like, what motivated me to do this. And it was, honestly, it was, like, kind of this sense of surprise and disgust of, like, I can't believe that no one has done this, and still I can't download it and play with it. And it's such a cool technology, you know, untraceable cash. No one thought to put that in there. You know, Lucre is still out there, Ben Laurie's math code, you know.
Uh-huh.
And then the other thing that motivated me was as I started looking at these systems, I started seeing how all the cool different concepts could be tied together.
Right.
Like you could have, first of all, like I would view at the core, the basic foundation is a normal account system like True Ledger that does a destruction of account history. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at its base, True Ledger right now, as far as I know, just does transfer, like account-to-account transfer.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, I would start adding the other instruments. For example, withdraw cash. Now, if you think about open transactions in an intuitive way, it's just like your bank account down the street. And any person understands intuitively what it means to go down to their bank account or go down to their bank and open an account. And they get a new account, they can open two or three accounts, then they get two or three accounts, right? And they can write checks, and they can withdraw cash,
mm-hmm.
and they can deposit checks and deposit cash. Everyone has an intuitive understanding of these concepts already. And it's the same thing digitally. So, you know, you sort of view the True Ledger as the core system that allows you to open accounts, transfer from one account to another account, and do it securely in a way where all parties can prove everything and there's no history needs to be stored. Okay. That's a good base foundation, right?
For a True Ledger. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for True Ledger. Well, Open Transactions uses a very similar system there because Open Transactions also does, like I said, destruction of account history. Okay? Mm-hmm. Well, I use a different mechanism that he does. It's a similar mechanism, but it's a different mechanism, but it still does that same idea of destruction of account history. But then on top of that, I have other instruments that I added, like checks, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I put checks on open transactions. But the critical thing to me that I thought was cool was I fit them into that system, that same, you know, metaphor, the inbox and the balance agreements and the transaction numbers and all that. I use that same system on my checks so that they fit into that same paradigm. Okay. And then with cash, I use the Lucre library. I mean, I still had to write my own mint class and token class and, you know, make mint files and have series and denominations and rotating mints and all this other spent token database, all these things I had to write to make it all work. But at the core of it, when I actually make the mathematics call, I'm using Ben Lurie's library, which is the Lucre library.
Okay.
And that makes it possible for me to do untraceable cash. And so it's the same as when you go down to your bank. If you go down to the bank and withdraw, say, $100, and then you give it to a prostitute, and then she gives it to her pimp, and then he gives it to his drug dealer, and his drug dealer goes and puts it back in the bank again, right, because he's going to college or whatever. Okay, so Now what does the bank see? The bank can see that you withdrew $100 from your account. Yes, okay? But they don't see that they see that you withdrew $100 from your account, and they also see that the drug dealer deposited $100. They can see that too. But what they can't see is that it's the same $100. They didn't know that it's the $100 that came from you. They didn't know where it came from when he deposited $100. They just knew it was $100. They didn't know where it came from. And they also didn't know who all had it in between, right? So they didn't know about the pimp and the prostitute and all that stuff in between because it's cash. And everyone understands this intuitively, that cash is untraceable in between, right? You can see the withdrawals and the deposits, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Well, digital cash does the same thing. So when you make a withdrawal from an open transaction server, then, you know, it's in cash form, and they can't see where it goes. And when someone deposits it, they can't see where it came from, and they can't see how many people had it in between.
Right.
You know?
So I can see how you're adding these additional layers. You started with the accounts transferring money back and forth between the accounts, and then you talked about check writing, and now you're talking about cash.
Well, here's why cash is so important.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Cash is important because in real life, you don't have to even have an account. You just go get some cash from someone, and you just get paid in cash, and you pay in cash. And you don't ever have to have an account, right? Well, that's the same exact thing that's true with open transactions. You can open an account or not, but either way, the cash is still good. You can still exchange the cash, verify the cash, use the cash, spend the cash. You can go completely cash only and be completely anonymous.
Right.
Using that system. And so, and by the way, that's what these guys are doing, like, what's his name? Sid and what's that project?
The VoucherSafe.
Yeah, VoucherSafe. That's a cool project. Those guys have cool ideas, you know? And I can tell that what they're doing is they're deliberately not having accounts. Because what happens is when you have accounts, then now you're liable for them.
Yeah, exactly, liability. I'm not sure how we plan on having these guys on for the show, but there's a difference between creating a system and then having a system and talking about how the stuff is stored. And if you have a situation similar to eGold and 1MDC where the eGold accounts, aside from the insecurity and all the problems with all of that, with the government and where it was stored and the legal issues, the 1MDC, they were doing transactions at another level while their account balance was maintained at a fairly stable amount. There were thousands of transactions happening on this kind of a meta level. And if you do that with the like a voucher type system or the digital cash system, you literally can store your gold. I mean, I'm not sure how the voucher safe is, if there's people implementing it as a real money system or if it's just this, a code system right now. I'm not too sure about how that's going along. But let's just say that you took your open transactions software right now, you could have deposited in a regular PEC Unix account $50,000 and do exchanges in and out at a level where with only with exchangers for $5,000 at a pop to get stuff in and out, and then issue all these tokens, and there can be millions of transactions happening with this cash based upon this stuff that's, you know, stored in the back. So if the PEC Unix or any of the holding organizations, it's like someone going to a bank and asking to look inside of a lockbox where the gold bar is to try to find out who's been doing transactions with it. And there's nothing there but just a gold bar.
Well, they can still freeze the account, though.
Yeah, well, you know, like, they did with the 1MDC.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, you may not be able to see what all the 1MDC transactions are, but you can still go to eGold and freeze the 1MDC account and take all their gold.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, there's still problems that need to be solved. I mean, there's all kinds of different problems that are solved in all directions, you know, but that's still an issue.
Yeah, that storage is an issue. But if you, the point that you had made before I went on out with that was about liability issues.
Exactly. I mean, basically, if you've got an account system, then you're liable to keep records on it and to know your customer and to report back if someone wants to look at a certain account and to, you know, produce information upon subpoena and all this sort of thing. And the only way that you can really not be held liable for all that is if you don't know it, if you don't have access to it.
Right. Just like
so they said, that's what they said. They said, well, we're not going to have any accounts. We're just going to have, this voucher system that's entirely cash only. And of course, they've got the whole warehouse receipt concept going on. I don't want to say that my system is, entirely comparable to theirs. But if you were to take open transactions and just turn off everything but just the cash only, then it's similar there. You know, what you've got is just no accounts, and everyone's just using cash, and it's cash only. You're just forcing all the users to only use this one instrument instead of having access to the various other instruments.
Okay.
You can certainly run it that way.
Why don't you tell us a little bit more about some of these things on the wiki page? Let me just go through this the features list here, and then we can jump around just for the record and the listeners. Featuring untraceable digital cash, real blinded tokens, pseudonymous user accounts, user account equals PGP key, many financial instruments, checks, cash, vouchers, invoices, transfers, anyone an issuer, Ricardian style contracts, triple signed receipts, asset account equals the receipt, basket currencies, markets with trades, let's get into that in a little bit, payment plans, reoccurring payments, native API now available in Ruby, Java, Python, PHP, Perl, C, C++, Objective-C, C#, TCL, and Lisp, open transactions as a web service, XML, RPC, HTTP, transfer, and then you say soon, and it sounds like you're, especially from some of the chats, that you're kind of having the system structured so that this stuff can be added. Stocks that pay dividends, bonds that pay interest, and collateralized debt obligations. And then real quick, two more things. 2D barcodes to make possible any screen, a cash register, any camera phone, a customer. That, you know, we discussed this issue, this little system with Alex Weed of the Pork Loom project, and he was wanting to do a system for over-the-counter exchanges and transactions in that Loom system using a iPhone or an Android phone with these 2D barcodes. It would be nice if whatever that application is that he's working on for the iPhone and or he's planning on, that there is a common API that could be used by several of these projects, so there's not duplicate interface development. There should be something that could be done there. And then you have multi-signer escrow, serial numbered warehouse receipts, property tiles, and arbitration. Those last three lines were coming soon.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, basically, you know, I built the core of the system, and many of the functions are fully, you know, fully functional, although still at an experimental stage, alpha stage. But like the accounts with the destruction of account history, that's all working with account to account transfer. The checks is all working. The cash is all working. Spent token database and everything.
Let me ask you a few things on that. What is the difference between checks and vouchers and invoices. How would those work differently?
Well, they're all basic variations on the same concept. Mm-hmm. So we all know what a normal check is. It's a little note that I sign and give to you that later on you can go and present it at the bank and they'll give you some money out of my account, right?
Yeah.
If I write you a check, say, hey, here's a check from fellow traveler to Metropipe, you know, and for 50 clams, right? And signed fellow traveler, I sign it, give it to you. Later on, you show up at the bank and you present that thing. You say, I want to deposit this into my account. Then they're going to go verify that I really signed it and that it's really for me and that, you know, I really authorized the instrument. And once they verify that, they'll take the money out of my account and they'll put it in your account and then they'll put a receipt into both of our inboxes.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the basic operation of a check. And, you know, of course, that changes my account balance. And so they need to keep a copy of that signed check around because I signed it that shows that I authorized the change in my account balance. See, your account is never really more than just inside your head. All the server really does is sign off on things that you've already stated, and then the server just verifies them and then signs them too.
Okay.
Like if you say, look, you know what, I want to open a clams account. Obviously, it's going to start with zero clams. And the server says, okay, you need a clams account, zero clams. Here's your receipt. So, like, is the clam account really stored on the server? No, not really. It's really stored in the receipt. It's really stored in my head. And the server is just like a notary that just signs off and says, okay, you said it, so I'll agree with it. Uh-huh. Now, later on, if some other guy has a clam account and he signs a request to give me five clams, right?
Yeah.
Then, and I sign a request to accept it, then this, again, the server's just agreeing with whatever we already said in our heads. The server just signs off on it and says, okay, you guys really said this, I'll sign it too. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Really, there is no other account other than just what's on the receipt, the last balance. And so because the check comes in, pops through later, yeah, I signed it, but it didn't change my balance when I signed it. It only changed my balance later when the guy cashed it. When the guy cashed it, then my balance changed. So now the bank's going to keep that check receipt around until I sign off on it on the new balance.
Okay.
And so there's never any balance in my account that I didn't sign first. Okay. I always sign first. And I can never later produce a receipt in a dispute without showing whatever my signed request was in the first place because it's included on the receipt.
Okay. Now, what would be the difference between that and a voucher and the way that it works?
A voucher is what I think in the UK they think of it as a banker's check. In mm-hmm. America they call it a cashier's check. And basically what it means is that normally if I write you a check, then the money comes out of my account and goes to your account. Okay? But if I purchase a cashier's check, then the money comes out of my account and goes to the bank, and then the bank gives me a check that's drawn on a bank's account.
Yeah. Right.
Right?
Okay.
So that's how the voucher works. It takes the money out of my account, goes to the bank, the OT server writes an internal server check, like a cashier's check, and that way I can give it to the recipient, and it works like a check, but the money's already out of my account, and it's drawn on a server account, so people usually trust the cashier's check more than they trust a normal check.
Right, right.
You know? Mm-hmm. For example, if you fail to pay your rent, then they'll insist that the rent check, let's say you bounced your rent check, mm-hmm. then they're going to insist that the next check be a cashier's check so they know that the money's there, right? It's drawn on a server account this time.
Okay. Right?
And so a voucher is just like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And how about invoice? What is the process for that?
Excuse me. An invoice is actually the same exact thing as a check, except it has a negative amount. Okay? Because I realized... Let's say that you're sitting there coding checks. You're actually coding this thing, right? And you say, okay, well, should I let them have a negative amount? You know, you have to put some code in there that says, no, this is not allowed. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know what? If I do let them have a negative amount, then it acts just like an invoice. Like, let's say that you did some service, or let's say that I did some service for you. I came over to your place, and I did some work on your computer, and then I gave you an invoice. And so I write out my account number, but instead of saying that I'm sending you 50 clams, I say I'm sending you negative 50 clams. Because really what this is an invoice that you're going to pay me 50 clams.
Yeah.
Now, you have it in your hand, and now it's your choice later on, which, just like a normal check, if you have a check, you're going to go deposit it. It's your choice what account you're going to deposit it to. I might not even know what accounts you have. You know, I just know your name, and I just make out the check to you, and then you go to the bank, and you deposit it into one of your accounts. Well, same thing. It's your choice if you want to pay the invoice or not. You say, okay, if I'm going to pay this invoice, I'm going to pay it out of this account. So you go and, you know, you go and you, it's like you deposit the invoice in that account, just like you would deposit a check. And the only difference is, instead of, you know, giving you money, they take it away.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the money just goes from this account to this account instead of from this account to this account. And then same thing, receipt goes to both sides, and it, you know, it never happens until both sides have signed off on it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah, it's interesting. Okay, down here, let's hit on just like fire through some of these. The basket currencies, how do you have that set up and how do you see that being used?
Well, in order to explain basket currencies, first I should say something very quick about Ricardian contracts.
Okay.
You know, I think that open transactions is cool because it combines several cool concepts that I always thought were cool concepts. One of them is Chomian blinding, the untraceable cash. You know, another one is the destruction of account history, you know, and another one is Ricardian contracts. And this is one of the cool concepts I always thought of financial cryptography. And it was invented by, I believe, Ian Grigg,
mm-hmm.
who worked for Systemics. And they actually had a transaction server they written called Ricardo.
Right. Yeah, I remember that.
And here's the idea that he had. He said, you know, let's say that I'm going to issue a currency. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take all the different things about this currency, like the currency symbol, the currency name in English, the currency name in Chinese, the currency website address, you know, the currency public key, you know, all these different things about the currency, and I'm just going to put them in an XML file, and then I'm going to sign it if I'm the issuer. So that's what a currency contract is. It's like a real contract. It's like a list of terms. So you can actually put all the English terms in there, the terms that will later come up in court. You say, well, what are the terms of this currency? Well, they're here in the contract. You pull them up. It's there in the XML file. There's the, you know, whatever terms you want. The redemption terms, the audit terms. You know, it's just like a real contract.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a very cool idea because for several reasons. First of all, instead of just opening accounts and being able to transfer from one account to another account, now you have the idea that the users can create their own currencies. You know, mm-hmm. And not all of them will.
Yeah.
Not all of them actually will create their own currencies, but they potentially could, and anyone could, and the ones that succeed will be the ones that, you know, people choose to use because they trust them more or whatever.
Right. One example, if I can interject here, is the Bitcoin, where someone can have a stash of Bitcoin or open up a business where they accept Bitcoins and issue accounts or open transactions, digital cash, based on those Bitcoins. That would be them issuing their own currency.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like let's say that I had 1,000 Bitcoins in my pocket. So I could go onto an open transaction server, and I can create a new currency that says, you know, this currency is backed in 1,000 Bitcoins. And I make the currency contract up. I put the public key in there. I sign the contract, upload it to the server. Now I'm the issuer of this new currency type. Right? Mm-hmm. And so Ricardian contracts means that anyone can define their own legal contract. It's a digital analog now of the legal contract. Mm-hmm. So we have a digital analog of checks, of accounts, of cash. Now we have the idea that a legal contract is also a digital instrument, which it perfectly is, and the server can enforce it.
Yeah, Nick, you know, someone who, for the record here, Nick Szabo, I think how you pronounce his name, did a lot of work on these concepts with what he called smart contracts. This is very similar.
Yeah, cool. Very cool, very cool. Like I said, I've kind of been out of the arena for a long time. I'm coming into this whole thing as an outsider, basically purely out of my frustration that no one else actually did this yet. I'm shocked. You know,
yeah.
I'm very disappointed and let down by the whole community that talked a lot of talk, and now it's like 2000 whatever, and I had to write this damn thing myself.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's because they took so long to start throwing people in prison, so they would have done that sooner than...
Right.
You know?
That's right.
You,
people always got to learn the hard way. First they came for E-Gold, but I didn't say anything. Then they came for 1MDC, but I didn't say anything because I didn't do that or whatever. I wasn't a porn guy.
Yeah, and then the Liberty Dollar.
You know, I don't know.
Right.
But here's what's interesting about Ricardian contracts. Number one, they're completely self-verifying. Because the ID of that contract is based on a hash of the contract. So if I take the contract and hash it, say with the SHA-1 hash or whatever hash, then now I get this little number. Well, if I take that same contract on a computer in China and hash it, I will get the same number. I'll get the same hash value out of it. So that means that you can use that hash value as the ID for the contract. That means on any computer in the whole world, if you take that same contract and hash it, you'll always get the same ID number come out of it. And if you change the contract by even one bit, then as a result of that, you'll get a completely different hash value would come out of the hash. And so that means you can't change the contract without changing the ID.
Right.
And so that means to me that, first of all, you can have all these contracts on different servers, and the ID is always consistent across servers, even though you don't have a directory server somewhere. Like DNS, right? There's a directory server that says, oh, this one is this one, and this ID is this one, and this ID is this one, right?
Yeah.
And then if someone has a bad directory server that authorities don't like, then they just go shut down the directory server. You know?
Yeah.
But in this case, there is no directory server because the same contract will automatically have the same ID on every server without having to look it up. You know? So I thought that was really cool.
Yeah,
and I realized that makes the contract self-verifying because let's say that I take a certain asset type ID for, like, let's say a silver grams asset type from some contract. If I download the contract, I can hash it and compare the output to the ID, and they should match. And if they don't match, that means someone gave me the wrong contract, right? Or someone changed the contract. I know for a fact the contract hasn't been changed. And then furthermore, I can take the public key that's inside the contract and use it to verify the signature on the contract, and that verifies. And now I know that, for example, if I want to talk to that person, I just talk to the address in the contract and use the public key in the contract so only that person can read it.
Right.
The contract's entirely self-verifying. In fact, I think that the same concept is useful as a solution for the whole DNS problem.
Yeah, you want to give us a couple of sentences on that?
Well, it's basically the same concept. Let's say that you had a website and you put a contract together, and you put the IP address and the I2P address and the Tor address and the, you know, IRC address and whatever other address. You put 20 different addresses in there.
Right, right.
And you say, and then you put a little statement in there that we are whoever and this is our contract. You know, and then you put the public key in there, and then you sign it. And then you distribute it. And anyone can say, here, check out this contract. And it's just like a key fingerprint, you know.
Exactly.
Just by knowing the contract ID, then someone knows, well, wait a second, this contract I'm holding here doesn't compute to that ID. This must be the wrong contract. Boom. You automatically know.
Right, and you can do that for a whole basket of information instead of having to individually do fingerprint verification for every single key or IP or cert or email address and domain name and stuff like that. Yeah, that's really nice. I like that.
Well, how? I mean, let's say you had a website. Well, let's say that you had a new top-level domain called JOG, right? So I'm going to have a website called fellowtraveler.jog. And then I have a little Firefox plugin that would say, oh, look, it's a JOG site, therefore I'm supposed to activate. And then it just goes and looks up all my contracts that relate to that site. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And most likely what I would do is I would do the same thing as I2P. I2P has a little local file that translates the name, like fellowtraveler.jog, it translates that to a hash value, like 1z83412.jog or whatever. Then it would just go and translate that, and then it would just use the hash value to look up the contract, and then it can look up the actual data through 20 different contact methods if it needs to.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, look it up.
You don't even have to have a DNS server. You don't have to have a DNS server anywhere, and as long as you're the one who signed the contract, then no one else can forge your signature.
Right. And as they do it now, the centralized servers are distributing all the information. They're not just distributing the hash. Because you could distribute this stuff in a P2P manner where all you do is just verify that hash. You don't even have to return all the information for the person to verify themselves. They can just have it, and if the hash matches up with their query, then it works.
Yeah,
I'll have to think about that some more. Okay,
so
that was leading us into basket currencies.
Right, basket currencies. So now we understand that what a Ricardian contract is, right? It's like a currency contract.
Right.
It's also a server contract. And it turns out that the Ricardian contract, I didn't really use the actual Ricardian contracts, but sort of the idea of having a signed XML file, that whole contract idea became the whole building block concept of the entire library of open transactions. And really everything is sort of based around that metaphor of the contract. Everything's a contract. Okay. Everything can be signed. It can be saved to file or sent over a pipe on the network, you know. And so what's a basket currency? Now, remember we discussed the idea of vouchers already, where it's like a cashier's check, where first I give the money to the server, then the server writes the check, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, similarly, let's say you want to have a basket currency made up out of gold and silver, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So let's say that, to make it easy, let's say someone's already defined this basket currency and it's 50% gold, 50% silver, whatever, right? So if you want to exchange into the basket currency, then all you have to do is you have to come up with some gold and some silver. And you go to the server and you say, hey, you know, I've got some gold and silver. Can you give me some of those, you know, rands or whatever they're called, whatever the basket currency is called?
Yeah.
So here's how Open Transactions does it. This is simplicity in form. Let's say that it's, two gold and two silver equals one basket, whatever the currency is called.
Mm-hmm.
So I show up and I say, look, here's 20 gold and 20 silver. Please give me 10 baskets. So the server says, okay. So he takes 20 gold and he puts it in a gold account, and he takes 20 silver and puts it in a silver account, and then he gives you 10 baskets. And the reason he does is because that's what the basket contract says. There's a basket contract that says 2 gold plus 2 silver equals 1 basket. And it's just in the contract. The server's just processing that contract. So what the server does is, really, if you're exchanging gold and silver in, the server just makes a little internal gold and silver account for that basket and stores your money in there. It just sits there. And meanwhile, you're out trading baskets. And you later on, if you want to come and exchange back and you say, look, here's 10 baskets. Again, I want my gold and silver back. The server just pulls the gold and silver back out of the same account where it was sitting the whole time and just gives it back to you.
Right.
Right? And so what's interesting about this is, it means that once you've exchanged in or out, all the magic is done. It means after that, a basket is just another asset type. It's just another ID. That's all it is. And so people think of baskets like, oh, well, doesn't that take a lot more computation? Like, what if I have 100 currencies? If I have 100 currencies in my basket, does it take 100 times as much computation? The answer is no.
No.
It takes exactly the same computation as any other currency, because once you've exchanged into the basket type, well, now it's just another unit in an account of a certain ID.
Yeah.
And, later on you can go and exchange back. You could even have infinitely nested baskets and it wouldn't use any more system resources.
Right.
Except for the exchange, when you exchange in and out. Right. And so, there's a lot of concepts build upon that as well. There's a lot of cool things you can do. Like, for example, that's what leads us to Bitcoin. I realized, wait a second, if my user is sitting there with an open transactions client and with a Bitcoin client, then he could say, hey, I want to in exchange some Bitcoin. Here's 100 Bitcoin. And the server can just take it and stick it in a Bitcoin hole somewhere and then give him, however many, 100 Bitcoin units on the server. Right, and then later on, if the user wants to exchange back out again, well, no problem. I'll just take the Bitcoin back out of the hole and just give it back to him. Right, but meanwhile, that allows me to have accounts based on it. That allows me to issue untraceable cash with Bitcoin reserves. That allows me to trade Bitcoins on markets against other asset types on the open transaction server.
Mm-hmm.
And that led me to start thinking about the combination, because remember, these all solve different problems. And Bitcoin is a cool idea. It's a cryptocurrency, right? It's P2P.
Yeah.
Right? And, that's a cool idea. Just like, you know, recording contracts or anything else, in my mind. Mm-hmm. Now, Bitcoin is, some people know this, some people don't, Bitcoin is fully publicly auditable. So you can actually look at the block trails, and they're auditable to the public. That's because, you know, it's P2P, there's no server, the people have to sign off on the transactions, and therefore, you know, people have to have access to them.
Right.
And so that's good and bad. It's good because that means if you use Bitcoin as a backing reserve currency on OT and issue, you know, instruments based on it, that means that the reserves are publicly auditable.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
Like if I open an account on Open Transactions that's like backed in eGold or PEC Unix, then you still have to have someone who's actually paid to go down there and make sure the gold is there. Someone mm-hmm. has to be some process and procedure where there's separation of powers and governance and access to the legal system, and there's people who go and count the gold bricks every 3 weeks and all this crap, right?
Mm-hmm. And the problem I mentioned earlier was where do you have your vault? And if there's some type of abuse and someone wants to go in there and use some accusations of abuse, or whether they're true or false, to just go ahead and shut down the account or to seize the asset, then you've just mooted your little solution for, like, the 1MDC solution was to the problem with eGold, with all the transactions being internally audited, was to have their sub-accounts and then all the other transactions happening at a different level. But then what happened? 1MDC got their accounts seized. So in this system here, you're talking about using Bitcoin as the money that's in the vault that's auditable, that it's there. And then on top of that, you issue tokens, and then you do all the magical stuff that you can do with, like, all of these little features and things we're talking about here.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're using Bitcoin as a reserve currency, then any of the users can audit and publicly and see that it's there and see that I really do have my reserves, right? And so there's that trust there. Now, the Bitcoin's publicly auditable, but once it's issued on an OT server, then you can use it as untraceable cash.
Mm-hmm.
You can use it, you know, right? And that's untraceable. And so, you know, here's another difference between Bitcoin and server-based systems. Bitcoin, because it's P2P, you have to have multiple people sign off on the blockchain before it becomes secure, right? And then the longest blockchain wins.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense? And so mm-hmm. that's basically all the computers are doing out there when they process Bitcoin transactions. They're just sitting there processing Bitcoin transactions, signing off on blockchains.
Right.
And so that's cool. I mean, I really like it. But the problem with it, though, is that it takes like 10 minutes to an hour to be really completely closed. You don't have an instant finality of settlement. You know, with a digital cash payment, you have instant finality of settlement. With Bitcoin, you know, I mean, it's pretty darn secure either way. But you know, if you're building a business based on it, you might want to have some kind of latency that waits 10 minutes to an hour before it considers a exchange really final.
Okay, right.
Before, you know, otherwise someone could go and buy some products from you, and then they go off and do a bunch of fraudulent signing on the BitChain really quick. And they can, you know, potentially forge a transaction. Now, I don't want to get a bunch of Bitcoin guys up in arms when I say something like that, because I view Bitcoin as extremely secure. I view it as a good system.
Mm-hmm.
But all I'm saying is that it is a known thing in the Bitcoin community that you kind of have to wait a few minutes sometimes for it to be completely closed and secure.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right? But let's say that you issued that Bitcoin on an OT server, then all the OT transactions are instant,
right?
And so I realized that it's just like the basket currencies, because mm-hmm. what you can do is you give me some Bitcoins, the server just sits on it for 10 minutes and then verifies, okay, enough people have signed the blockchain, okay, I'll give him his 10 Bitcoins now, puts it in your account. Then you can go and trade off with it. You have instant finality of settlement, no wait at all. And if there's any merchants out there that are worried about having to wait 10 minutes or wait an hour, now they can have instant finality of settlement, and the server is the one who deals with the 10-minute wait whenever, and that's only when people exchange in and out, not when they have to do every single transaction.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I thought, you know, this is interesting that Bitcoin and open transactions solve different problems, but they're very complementary, you know?
That ends part one of our interview with fellow traveler on open transactions. Tune in tomorrow and we'll continue with Bitcoin in part two. You can check it out live or in the podcast.
Dodge this.
This is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. AgoristRadio.com is sponsored by MetroPipe.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
Broadcasting from deep within the second realm, you are listening to AgoristRadio.com.